So the book of Nehemiah divides into two, as I said. The first seven chapters, if you want a heading, you could write over them construction. And the main person in that section is Nehemiah. But then the second half of the book, from chapter 8 to verse 13, is instruction. And instead of Nehemiah being the main man, Ezra is the main man. So Ezra is a priest and a scribe. So it's very neatly divided into those sections. Now what we're going to do is look at the first half. We're going to miss out chapter 7 because it's mainly a genealogy. But I'm going to look at the first six chapters, and these will be our headings as we go through. So chapter 1 I'm going to call Nehemiah's heart, because he looks at the state of things and he's grieved in his heart and he's prayerful and he's burdened. So Nehemiah's heart, chapter 1. Chapter 2, Nehemiah's feet. So Nehemiah takes a journey all the way from Babylon to Israel. He goes all around the city of Jerusalem, so Nehemiah's feet. Chapter 3 is Nehemiah's eyes. So as he goes around the wall, he sees what this man's doing, and he sees what this woman's doing, and he writes down everything that they're doing. Then chapter 4, Nehemiah's hands. So we've got a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other, and he's working away at rebuilding the walls. Then chapter 5, Nehemiah's tongue, which he uses to rebuke the nobles, and finally, chapter 6, Nehemiah's mind, or his will, because he remains steadfast under a very, very clever assault upon the work. So let's just set the context of this. I know our context is rather boring, but if you don't get this bit, you won't really get the rest of it. In fact, if you can get hold of what I'm going to say in the next few minutes, it will unlock most of the Old Testament. You know, when I was growing up reading my Bible, I would read about the king of Israel was 24 years old when the king of Judah began to reign. And then the king of Judah died, and he was, and I thought, what is this? These sort of parallel sets of kings. And, of course, I discovered it went back to the split after the death of Solomon, when there was a rebellion. So the Davidic line continued with just a couple of tribes, Judah and Benjamin, and this rebel line with all these imposter kings continued separately. So they were Israel, the 10 kings in the north, and Judah, the 2 tribes in the south, 10 tribes and 2 tribes. Now, another thing that preachers used to talk about when I was young that I didn't understand was the captivity. And they were always on about this captivity, and I thought, what is this captivity? I imagined it was just one thing, but actually it's 2 things. So the captivity is the 10 tribes were taken captive because of their sin, their immorality, not keeping the Sabbath for the 7th year. They were taken into captivity in 721 BC, and they were taken to Assyria, capital of which was Nineveh. If you ever get the chance to go to London, go to the British Museum and you can see it all there. Then Judah, who lasted a bit longer than Israel because they were slightly better, they were taken captivity in 606 BC, 600 years before Christ, and they also go to the same part of the world, by which time it's not called Assyria, it's called Babylonia, because the Assyrian Empire has collapsed and it's now the Babylonian Empire, but they all really ended up in the same place. Now, as prophesied by Jeremiah, 70 years after that second captivity, quite a few people came back, nowhere near the total, only like 42,000, I think it was. There was probably 1 million of them by this stage in Babylon. But anyway, there was a small remnant came back. You can't go that way. You have to go up and down the river Euphrates and down into Judah. So they came back and they started rebuilding everything that had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar when he took them captive in 606. And the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah tell that story of the rebuilding of everything that had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, the main event in the book of Ezra, which we're not going to discuss tonight, is the rebuilding of the altar and the temple by a man called Zerubbabel. So that's not our subject tonight, but they came back, and that's what they got done first. Then there's a gap of about 100 years, and Nehemiah comes, and he rebuilds the walls and the gates. So you've got 2 books talking about 2 rebuilding projects, and they're very, very similar in many ways. They were given permission to do it by a Medo-Persian king. They do the 1,000-mile journey. They start to rebuild. They get opposition. They overcome the opposition, and they finish. And you say to yourself, well, why do we need... Why didn't they just get on and build the whole thing once? Or why didn't they build the wall first and then the temple? Why did they get the temple first and then there's this gap and then they build the walls? Well, therein lies a very important lesson. And these things were written for our learning. Build the temple first is a biblical principle. You say, what are walls and gates for? So the temple and the altar was first. 100 years later, walls and gates. Walls are for separation, to keep things out. Gates are for protection, to make sure that where you've got a gap in the wall, you've now got a gate, and it's also... So separation and protection. Now, let's just think of... First of all, let's think about our personal lives. In our personal lives, we need to build the temple first. And I'm talking about every day of the week. We need to build the temple first. And if we don't build the temple first, you can build as many walls and as many gates as you like. But you've got it all back to front. So let's just imagine a Christian who really believes very much in separation. And he doesn't smoke and he doesn't drink and he doesn't go to the movies and he doesn't swear and he doesn't... He doesn't do anything. He's absolutely separate. He's got walls and gates around everything. And just to make sure that he's separated, he puts extra walls around the walls. And he makes up a whole bunch of rules that aren't in the Bible to keep him separate to the nth degree. But he never reads his Bible. And he never prays. And he never worships. And he never sings. And he's hard to live with. And he's always losing his temper. And he's not growing. He's not developing. What's his separation worth? Zero. You might as well be a Hutterite or an Amish or anything. If your Christian life is just a bunch of rules that you keep because you really believe in separation, but there's not a spiritual understanding that is informing that separation and driving that separation... So I'm not just separate because I believe in ticking a lot of boxes and because I tick 5 boxes, I'm a good brother in the meeting. No, the main thing is to build the temple first. Have a relationship with the Lord Jesus. And if you have a relationship with the Lord Jesus and you are a worshipping, warm-hearted, Bible-believing, Bible-following Christian, the separation will still be there, but it will be balanced. And it will be driven by your devotion to the Lord, not your devotion to rules and regulations. Am I clear? That's why this was done in this way. Build the temple first. So let's look at chapter 1. Nehemiah's in Shushan. So that's, as I said, in modern Iran, down by the Persian Gulf. But although he's in Shushan, his heart is somewhere else. His heart is in Jerusalem, 1,000 miles away. And he receives this report, possibly from his own blood relative. It talks about one of his brethren, maybe his brother. But anyways, somebody, a group of men, visit all the way from Jerusalem. Sorry, you're going this way. All the way from Jerusalem over to Shushan, the palace. And they tell Nehemiah. Nehemiah says, how are they getting on? Now, he had a big job in Shushan, and he hadn't gone back with the captives earlier. So he says, how are things going? And they tell him, it's a mess. They haven't even rebuilt the walls yet. The gates are all burned, the whole place, and they're under affliction. And he really takes it very badly. You know, he could have said, oh, well, who cares? That's not my concern. It's 1,000 miles away. I'm busy, I've got a big job here, you know, you better get back there and sort it out. No, he sits down, he weeps, he fasts, he prays for days. So I wonder, what kind of a man was he? He was a man with a concern for the people of God, for the house of God, for the temple of God, for the city of God, Zion. Even though it's 1,000 miles away, you know, it's like going on holiday and it's Tuesday and you're in Florida. Wouldn't that be nice this time of year? You're in Florida and it's Tuesday and, you know, you're on the beach and it's 7 o'clock and you think, wonder how the prayer meeting in Windsor's going. Did you do that? Or did you just go away and think, oh, good, got away from them. I don't have to go to any meetings and I can just go to the beach. You see, the fact that he was miles away, he was still interested in what's going on in the house of God. What was the problem? There's a problem with the walls. There's a problem with the gates. So let's transfer that now into our situation. We don't have a physical city. We don't have a physical land. We don't have an army. There's a big difference between Israel and the church. They're not the same. They never have been the same, and they never will be the same. But we can take this lesson from the children of Israel. They had a problem with walls and gates. Did you know we have a problem with walls and gates? In the assemblies. I talk about in the church. So the temple, the house of God in the Old Testament, I'm just using that as a sort of a picture of the house of God today. The local assembly is house of God. It's temple of God. That's his character. You say, what do you mean? What does it mean if an assembly has a problem with its walls and its gates? Does it mean we've got to go out and fix? No, I'm talking spiritually. Walls and gates. So walls and gates spiritually means separation and protection of the local assembly. See, what happens if we don't keep the assembly separate and protected? Well, it will be damaged. It will be ruined. And it'll probably go out of existence or change its character altogether. You say, how do you know that? Because I come from the UK. And since the Second World War, 1,000 assemblies have closed in the UK. Just try and compute that. I have checked that number, not literally to what exactly 1,000, but that is a true fact. All facts are true, but that is true. You say, why did they close? Well, there's a whole bunch of reasons why they closed. Some are just demographics. People used to be in the rural places and then they all moved to the cities and so they couldn't keep going. Some are just reflective of the secular change in society. So not only have 1,000 assemblies closed, but thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of other churches have closed. Thousands of them. I'm talking about every village in England that used to have the Church of England one end and a little evangelical chapel at the other end. I don't know hardly any of those chapels that are not turned into houses and carpet warehouses and whatever. There's been a lack of teaching, as in we're not feeding the flock, so they drift off and go elsewhere. There's been a lack of gospel work. People used to put up gospel tents and, you know, they would be known in the neighbourhood and they would put texts up on the railway station. So there's a whole lot of reasons why the assemblies have suffered. But one major contributor is a lack of separation and a lack of protection. You say, what does that mean? Well, what that means is there are certain things that individual Christians and groups of Christians should be separate from. We should be separate from error. We should be separate from false doctrine. We should be separate from false teachers. We should be separate from groups that are teaching false things. That's why we don't join in with the ecumenical movement. That's why we're not marching down the street against abortion hand in hand with the Orthodox and the Catholics and everybody else. Why? Because the Bible tells us not to have fellowship with things that are unscriptural. But sadly, many assemblies over the years... Well, let me tell you what happened in England. In England, each assembly used to do its own sort of gospel effort. And then along came an evangelist from America by the name of Billy Graham. And he held some gospel meetings in a place called Haringey. It went on every night for 6 weeks, which is amazing. And instead of thinking, there's probably dangers involved in something like that, that's going to involve all kinds of links with all kinds of people, and at the end of the day, he preaches is a kind of a decision-based gospel where you come to the front and sign a card and you're saved, and then they send you back to the denomination you came from. But no, the assembly said, let's join in. And 28% of the councillors came from gospel halls. You say, what's a councillor? A councillor is someone who is hired by the Billy Graham organisation, used to be, well, I suppose probably still is, now that Franklin has taken Billy's place. And they will be there at the front. And when the invitation is given to get up out of your seat while Just As I Am is being sung, they come down to the front and they're met by a councillor who leads them to Christ. It gets them to sign a piece of paper. And 28% of the people that did that in the Haringey Crusade were from gospel halls. Now, what that did was two things. It opened up the hearts and minds of young people to this whole new universe that they'd never seen before, this massive, the choirs, and them is like going back to the little gospel after that was a bit of a letdown. And also, it sort of think, well, that was a much better way of seeing people saved than us putting up our tent. And so a lot of assemblies stopped doing gospel work and waited for the next visit from Billy Graham or Lewis Palau or whoever it is. Now, back when that happened in London, there were dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of assemblies. There was one assembly in London that at one point had 700 in fellowship. Do you know how many assemblies there are in London now? I don't think there are any more than 200 people in fellowship in a gospel hall in London. And those that are there are struggling. I would say less than 0.1% of the people in London know what a gospel hall is. They have become a total irrelevance. Why? One of the reasons was they let the walls down. They didn't take a strong stand for truth, a strong stand for a biblical gospel. They mixed in with the ecumenical movement. Now, not everybody did. To their credit, Martin Lloyd-Jones, if you've ever heard of him, a great Welsh preacher, Martin Lloyd-Jones says, we're going to have nothing to do with this. And there was a huge fallout between Martin Lloyd-Jones and John Stott. John Stott was a reverend gentleman in All Souls Church in London. And he and Martin Lloyd-Jones had a big fallout about this. Not that they were nasty to each other, but they took a... Martin Lloyd-Jones said, we can't sit on the platform with bishops from the Church of England and cardinals from the Catholic Church and all be lovey-lovey just because Billy's here. We can't do that. Whereas John Stott said, oh, yes, we can. Isn't it amazing that Martin Lloyd-Jones saw a clearer vision of the truth than we did? The walls came down. And when the walls come down, you're in trouble. Another thing that happened in England was that many assemblies either never had proper reception policies or became much more relaxed and open in their reception policies. Now, by reception, I'm talking about membership of the local assembly. So in England, back then and to this day, many, many assemblies, if someone walks in on a Lord's Day morning and says, I'm a Christian, they say, welcome, they sit down and they break bread. It's called open table reception. And that was a very common thing, still is common in England and in other parts, not so much in Northern Ireland, but definitely very much in England. And that policy of just having no doors, effectively, just anybody can come in, well, it resulted in disaster. Now, I have stood on the door on a Sunday morning in assemblies for probably 30 years. I just moved to another place where, thankfully, I don't have that responsibility, but I have stood on the door for 30 years. And I could tell you story after story after story after story of people who walked in who, if we had just received them, it would have been a disaster. I'll tell you one story. One lady walked in and people walk in 1 minute before the time, so I never sit and explain the whole thing about, you know. I just say, welcome, delighted to see you. Come on in, I'll show you to the guest row, and just sit them down. Do the explaining later. That was the view I took. So anyway, this lady came in, she sat down, and so when the meeting was over, I went up to her and I said, well, what did you think of the meeting? And she said, well, yeah, it was nice, but I was a bit upset that I wasn't allowed to take the emblem, take communion. So I didn't really go into any explanation. I just thought, well, you know, there's no point us falling out about that. So we just, I moved the subject on and we got talking and, you know, what do you do for a job? And then I said to her, so why do you, where do you live? That's right. She said she just moved to the town. And I said, where do you live? She said, oh, I live with my boyfriend in, and she named an estate of houses. Well, I nearly fell off my seat because I'm speaking to this lady and without so much as blinking, she's just told me that she's upset that she wasn't able to take communion, but she's living with her boyfriend. But she says she's a Christian. You see, if we don't have walls and we don't have gates, you'll have fornicators breaking bread just like that, because what people say at the door, oh yes, I'm a Christian, may have absolutely nothing to do with biblical Christianity. So we need walls and we need gates, and we need to understand that fellowship is not coming in and breaking bread, and reception is never to the breaking of bread. Reception is to the church. The church receives, the church disciplines if it has to, you receive to the church. So if you're a brother and you're received, you're able to take part, you're able to stand up and give out a hymn or give us a little word of ministry. And if we have no gates and no doors, believe me, if you don't believe it from the ministry, just believe me from the history. It is disastrous. Now, the other side of that is we need to be friendly, we need to be warm, we need to welcome visitors, we need to make sure that they don't go home saying, no one spoke to me, no one shook my hand, all of that. I take that as read. But this is the problem. And this is why Nehemiah was upset. Does the state of the assemblies upset you? It should do. It should really upset you. When you hear of an assembly closing, that should really upset you. When you hear of an assembly going off in this direction. And it's not far away from here, this is what's happening. We're no longer requiring head coverings. Next week we're having a conference and we're bringing in Dr. So-and-so, DD from such and such a Bible college to speak to us. And the walls are falling down and the doors are left open. And we wonder why we suddenly lost our character and our New Testament pattern. And Nehemiah's very, very burdened about this. So, in chapter 2 we get to his feet. 4 months later, he's still so upset that his king notices it in his face. And we had that conversation. He has that quick prayer. And you know what happens? The king says to him, well, if you want to go and rebuild those walls, get on with it. How long are you going to be? When are you going to come back? And he sends him on his way. Did you know that the assemblies are crying out for people like Nehemiah? Who will get up and do something. Get on their feet and not sit there wailing and complaining about the way things used to be. All right. I remember once speaking to my dad and complaining about this and that and the other in the assembly. And I was about 15 at the time. And he said to me, what are you going to do about it? Make it different by one man. And I've since discovered that one young couple in an assembly with a bit of enthusiasm, a bit of vision can make a great difference. You don't need a whole lot of new programs and a whole lot of new ideas. You just need some Nehemiahs. People to come in and build the thing up and have an exercise and have a burden that's infectious. You see in that chapter there, he says rise up and build. And the next thing is, let's all rise up and build. Isn't that great? When someone comes in with a little bit of enthusiasm. But I don't see so much of that these days. I see everything being sort of slimmed down version of meetings, slimmed down version of assemblies. Let's all get it over and done with as quickly as we can. And oh, how long is a tent meeting going to go on for? And, you know, it's all everybody's dragging their feet. That's not what happens when you get revival. There was a revival in Northern Ireland in the year 2001. Murray McCandless and Peter Orosek had 19 weeks of meetings in a place called Coleraine, and 52 people professed to be saved. And an elder in that meeting said to me, halfway through those meetings, I have lost interest in everything else other than these meetings. He said, I don't go to the shop and buy my newspaper anymore. I'm sure he went back to the newspaper later, but in the middle of that revival, it was just like, this is it. This is why I'm here. This is what life's all about. And that's what Nehemiah was like. Did you know that when he went to see the king and asked him to give him permission to go to Jerusalem, and the king got out his pen and wrote, "You have permission to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem," he kicked off the stopwatch for the greatest prophecy in the Bible. Nehemiah did not know that. But if you've ever heard of something called Daniel's 70 weeks, do not glaze over because I've mentioned Daniel's 70 weeks. If you've ever heard of the prophecy of Daniel's 70 weeks, which is the greatest prophecy in the whole Bible, in the book of Daniel, it's a 490-year period. It began on the day that Nehemiah said, "I want to go to Jerusalem." So some little thing that you do for the Lord might have very big significance. Very big significance. Just picking up a child for Sunday school might have huge significance in 20 years' time. 10 years time. What if that child gets saved and then brings the whole family and they all get saved? You know how many Kembers there are in the assemblies of Northern Ireland? Do you know how that all started? Two evangelists walked up to the door of great granddad Mr. and Mrs. Kember. That's how it starts. Same with the Griffins. And in our country we have all sorts of families like that where somebody got saved and down the line, look at this, look at the blessing. Well, Nehemiah, he wasn't worried about that. He just got on with it. And he goes on this long journey and he's infectious and he gets everybody enthused. And then we move into chapter 3 and we've got Nehemiah's eyes. It's the great building chapter, chapter 3. It's very warm in here. I'm having to work hard to keep you awake. The great building chapter, chapter 3. It's the Old Testament equivalent of 1 Corinthians chapter 3. It's easy to remember. Nehemiah 3, 1 Corinthians 3. Nehemiah 3, they're building the walls of Jerusalem. 1 Corinthians 3, they're building the local assembly. So what do we need for building the local assembly? We need a foundation. Jesus Christ is the foundation. And then on top of that, you build silver and gold. That is, you build according to the wisdom of God, not the wisdom of men. The wisdom of men says, pile up a load of wood, hay and stubble. Cheap, quick, easy. No, no. Assembly building's not quick, cheap and easy. If you want to build up an assembly that's scriptural and solid, full of saved people who want to obey their Bibles, it's going to take you some time. And it's just a little bit of gold here, a little bit of silver there, and a little bit of precious stones there. And it could be all destroyed in a moment of time. Here's Nehemiah. And he goes around the wall and he inspects it. It's almost like the judgment seat of Christ, chapter 3. He's going around. Let me tell you about five people he notices. He notices willing people. There's priests and Levites, there's goldsmiths, there's perfume makers, there's some women, there's some men, there's some rulers. They're all at it. There's something for you to do in God's assembly. What are you doing? Oh, well, I. No, no, what are you doing? Surely you're doing something. Did you ever hear the story about that church that had three people in it? There was everybody, Mr. Everybody, Mr. Somebody, and Mr. Nobody. Ever heard about that story? And there was some job needed to be done. There was probably a sweet wrapper on the floor that needed to be picked up. Now, everybody thought somebody would do it. So do you know who did it? Nobody. That's the way it works. That is the way it works. So you go to the washroom and there's no paper towels in the paper towel dispenser. What do? Well, everybody thinks somebody will do it. So you know who does it? Nobody. And we all come out of the washroom like this. Nehemiah wasn't like that. And neither were the people on the wall. They were willing. There's another type of people. They were committed. Verse 6 of chapter 4 says they had a mind to work. Do you know how long it took them to build the walls? 52 days. That's some going. That's less than 2 months. So they've been wrecked for 100 years and he has it done in a month and a half. So they're willing, they're committed, they're enthusiastic. Chapter 3, verse 20 talks about a man called Barak and he zealously repaired. Now, I can't do bricklaying, but there must be a way of doing it in a lazy way and a way of doing it in a zealous way. And he did some zealous bricklaying. That's what we need. We need zealous preaching. We need zealous singing. We need zealous amens. We need zealous handshakes. We need zealous fellowship. Number four, not only willing and committed and enthusiastic, they were collaborative types of people. Did you see that? He built this next to him. He built next to him. He built this next to him. Isn't that great? In England, in Ireland where I'm now as well, we have lots of open air meetings, lots of street meetings. And, you know, if you're on your own, I've done lots of preaching on my own in all sorts of places, but I'm much happier if I've got somebody with me. It's just some moral support. My wife comes with me, and that's great. Someone to go and get you a cup of tea or give you a little time to sit down and take a break. Somebody next to you. That's what fellowship is. And we're next to one another. And we believe the same thing. And we have the same mind about things. And we're all in the work together. And we're not turning up at the meeting thinking, well, brother so-and-so's not here, and sister so-and-so's not here, and we all feel deflated. It's great when everybody's next to one another. And then last of all, there were some humble people. Chapter 3, verse 14. There's a man called Malchiah. Do you know what gate he built? The Dung Gate. Not a very polite name, is it? The Dung Gate. You say, what kind of a gate? Could I have a glass of water, please? Nope, I'm not missing one. The Dung Gate. What kind of a gate was the Dung Gate? Well, it was where all the rubbish from the city was taken out of the city. So it was probably a pretty stinky kind of place. Not the kind of place you want to work. It's not like an air-conditioned office with, incense sticks and all the modern accoutrements. This is a dump. And yet Malchiah, he goes down to the Dung Gate on his own. Now, the Dung Gate was essential for the health of the city and the cleanliness of the city. You know, there are some jobs in the assembly that are not very pleasant to do. Someone has to clean the washrooms. Oh, don't give me that job. I'd rather arrange the flowers. Well, that's not the spirit of Malchiah. He was willing to, thanks Daniel, he was willing to clean the Dung Gate. But the thing I like is that Nehemiah, who I take as a picture of the Lord at this point, he's watching everything that's being done and he notices it all. He doesn't say, oh, the Fountain Gate, there's a great group there. And he just, oh, let's not all mention Micaiah down at the Dung Gate, sure. No. The Lord notices it all. You might think standing up here is what the Lord notices. I don't think so. I do not think so. I don't expect the preachers to be in the front row at the judgment seat. And I mean that honestly. The foot soldiers in the assembly is what really matters. So don't think anything you are doing in the Windsor Assembly or Stark Road or wherever you're from tonight, if you teach a Sunday school class, if you do the hall cleaning, if it's your responsibility to cut the hedge, whatever it is, the Lord notices it and he will reward it. You know, when I was young, I thought, I'm going to get nothing at the judgment seat. I'm a rubbish Christian. And then I heard Sidney Maxwell one day say, even one heartbeat of affection for Christ will be rewarded at the judgment seat. I thought, oh, I think I might have one of those somewhere. Everything will be rewarded if it's done for the Lord. We can't tarry. Time is moving on. Chapter 4, Nehemiah's hands. Oh, now you see they're building. There's opposition. You have this Samaritan man, Sanballat. And an Ammonite called Tobiah. You have an Arab chief who's in control of Edom and Moab. He's called Geshem. Now, Ammonites, Moabites, Edomites and Samaritans are all related to Israel, but they're not true Israelites. They're sort of half Israelites. If you go back in history, they're related. Edomites come from Esau. So Jacob and Esau, take it down the line, the children of Israel, the Edomites. So they're sort of brothers, but the Edomites were bad news. So what do they represent, all these Ammonites, Moabites, Edomites? They represent a mixed multitude. In fact, they're called a mixed multitude in chapter 13, verse 2. In New Testament terms, they're wolves in sheep's clothing. They are false brethren. They are angels of light, giving the impression that they're saved, but they're not. Paul warns about them in 2 Corinthians. Don't let those kinds of people into the assembly. So they come up and they start mocking. They start mocking these Jews who are clambering over these walls and trying to get their rubbish sorted out. And they just sit there with their arms folded and they say, "Look how small you are." Have you ever heard that? How many are in your church? 40? 40! We've got 4,000 on a Sunday morning. We have two services and... Well, never worry about that. You just do what's right. Do the next right thing. Keep building for God. No matter how many times you get mocked. It's sad when Christians would mock other Christians because they're in a small church. I mean, is that Christian to do that? And then they say... Well, actually, they go from mocking to being angry. Very spiritual, weren't they? They mock the Christians. Oh, look at your little thing that you're doing, that little church down there. Now they get when it actually starts to go and there's a bit happening and the walls are coming up, then they get angry. And they organise themselves into a formidable group. It was called a conspiracy in verse 8 of chapter 4. See, these kind of tribes, they were actually sometimes fighting each other. But now that the Jews are building the wall, they've all joined up together. Like Pilate and Herod, they made friends. And they're all now against the assembly. They're against the temple. Now, what was the motive of their opposition? Well, just the usual stuff. Who's in charge? Status. Power. I mean, what was wrong with rebuilding Jerusalem? It's one of the greatest cities the world's ever seen. Let them go on with it. Oh, but if they manage to do that, then we're going to lose our power and that they'll be better than us. And that spirit has torn apart more assemblies than anything else. Who gets to be top dog? Who gets to be on the oversight? Who gets to do this and do that? And if anybody else steps on their toes, boy, the whole atom bomb goes up. But the thing is, there wasn't a spiritual bone in their body. They wanted to stage a coup and take over, but they weren't spiritual men. Now, there were three additional problems. They were in cahoots with some of the people in Jerusalem. So just picture the scene. You've got these men that are trying to stop Jerusalem being rebuilt, and you've got some men inside Jerusalem working with them. Now, in wartime, you call that a fifth columnist, someone that's for the enemy, but in the other camp. And there's a man called Tobiah here, and there's a man called Nehemiah building, and there are these people who they go to Tobiah and tell him everything that Nehemiah's doing, and then they come back to Nehemiah and tell him everything that Tobiah's doing. They're the worst kind of people in all the world. You do not want people like that in the assembly. who they'll go and say, you know, what they think you want to hear. And then they're down the road another day telling them what they want to hear. That's what these people were like. So they had a problem with bias. They had a problem with gossip. They had a problem with negativity. 4 verse 10. Oh, the strength of the bearers of burdens is decayed and there's much rubbish and we're not able to build the wall. And we're plagued with those kinds of people too. Well, it's raining a bit, you know. We can't go tracting, it's raining. And, the snow's coming, we'll just cancel everything. Oh, we can't have a conference, you know, it's too much hard work and the sisters can't agree what dessert to serve people. Let's just cancel it. Let's just stay on Zoom forever and quick and easy religion, whatever way it is. Just, no. None of this negativity. Nehemiah says, no. Do not be afraid. Keep praying. In fact, he led by example. Do you know what it says? It says he stayed in Jerusalem and he never took his clothes off except for washing. He went to bed fully dressed unless it was time to and he had a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. There's a magazine that's been printed in London for about 150 years, and it's called The Sword and the Trowel. Do you know who invented that magazine? Charles Spurgeon. And Spurgeon called his magazine The Sword and the Trowel because he wanted to talk about building and defending what you build. Building and defending what you build. Are you willing to build? You say, oh, I think so. Are you willing to defend what you build? So we're building the assembly, and we believe in principles. We believe in a weekly breaking of bread, and we believe in elders, and we believe in headship, that is the order of male and female. And we believe in the Lord's coming before the tribulation. And okay, so we build that up, and we teach that, and we have Bible class and ministry and all that. And then along comes someone who wants to change it all. Oh, I don't want to get involved. Oh, I don't want to say anything. There's no point building something if you're not willing to defend what you build. Now, I'm not saying be unwise and have a fight. But there is a way to stand up and defend what we believe and what we're trying to build. So, chapter 5, Nehemiah's tongue. So we've had Nehemiah's heart, chapter 1, his feet, chapter 2, his eyes, chapter 3, his hands, chapter 4. Now in chapter 5, we have his tongue. Now, it was a bit like what happened in the book of Acts. In the book of Acts, the first bit of opposition came from without. So you have the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin trying to stop the apostles preaching. And then in chapter 6, you have problems from... Well, chapter 5 and 6, you have problems from within. You have Ananias and Sapphira telling their lies, and you have the struggle about the widows and the food. Now, this is very similar to what happens in Nehemiah. You have trouble from without, Tobiah, Geshem, Sanballat. Now in chapter 5, you have trouble from within. Now, it's a little bit of a complicated chapter, but basically the rich Jews were exploiting the poor Jews at the time of this trouble. So it's like a cost of living crisis, and the rich Jews were taking advantage of the poor Jews, and they were lending them money at high interest and everything. So Nehemiah says, right, we need to sort this out. And he calls a public meeting in chapter 5, verse 7, and he rebukes them. He basically silences them. When he's finished in verse 8, they've got nothing to say. It's a bit like Titus chapter 1, verse 11, whose mouths must be stopped. And when a false teacher comes in, you've got to be able to answer. You've got to be able to put them to silence and say, no, 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 we don't believe that here. We believe what the Bible says. And he silenced this situation. He got it turned around. Now, the thing that really interested me most of all in chapter 5 was he didn't just read the riot act to them, if you know what that means. He said, you shouldn't be charging your brethren interest, because I don't charge the brethren interest. Because he'd lent money with no interest. So what he was able to do was to speak from his personal integrity. He said, I've got a lot of power around here. I've got letters from the king of the world, Artaxerxes, to do what I'm doing. But I haven't been taking advantage of anybody. I haven't been saying, do this, do that. No, I've got involved. I'm keeping my clothes on at night. I've got the sword and the trowel, and I'm lending money around, but I'm not taking interest. So he wasn't saying, do as I say, but don't do as I do. He set the example. That's the best way to get people to follow you. Just set an example. If you want someone to do something, the carrot's much better than the stick. Give them a reason to do it. Catch them doing something right, not doing something wrong. You know, the first time you get spoken to sometimes is the first time you say something wrong in a prayer on Sunday morning, you know. Three people come to you at the end. You said something wrong in your prayer. No, no, no. If you ever have to do that, make that a really big exception and make sure that if you do that once, 9 other times you've gone up to that young brother and said, I really enjoyed your worship this morning. It was really, really nice. I especially enjoyed your thought about that. And have you ever thought of this? Do that about 9 times before you do this other thing 1 time. And Nehemiah, he doesn't discourage them. He just says, listen, this is the way we should be conducting ourselves. Let's get on with it. Now, 2 minutes. Chapter 6, Nehemiah's mind. What an extraordinary man he was. What I like about him most of all is his indomitable spirit. Look at what he's come through. This 1,000-mile journey, all the discouragement of Sanballat and Tobiah, all the defeatist attitude of the Jews. Now he's had a crisis of this high interest. I mean, stressful or what? And then you come to chapter 6, and the biggest test of all comes. These same boys, Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, they come back not to fight him, but to trick him. And they say, we'd like to have a nice little cozy chat. Let's go to Starbucks and let's just talk about these walls. Now, Nehemiah wasn't only a very enthusiastic brother. He was very, very discerning. And he says to himself, and these people don't want to chat. They just want to stop the work. He says, oh, no, I'm not coming for a chat. I'm building. Email number 2 comes in. We want to chat. I'm building. Email number 3. I'm building. Email number 4. I'm building. Email number 5. I'm building. Yeah, there are people who will try and stop you building. All sorts. Some from within, some from without. Now, some of them you might want to talk to, but a lot of time you just say, I'm not going to reply to that email. I'm busy. I'm building. I don't suggest you should be rude, but this was a trap. It says in chapter 6, verse 12, I perceived God had not sent him. And there's a man called Shemaiah in chapter 10. We didn't read about him. He comes to Jeremiah, to Nehemiah, and he says, oh, I think we should go into the temple and hide in the Holy of Holies. They're out to kill you. And he was actually a secret agent of Tobiah. So he posed as trying to save Nehemiah from death when he was actually trying to get him killed. You say, would anybody do that? And some weird and wonderful things happen in churches. We need to be discerning. We had a fellow turned up not that long ago for the midweek meeting. And he walked in and sat at the back. Not the back seat, but he was just on the back row. And I thought, oh, great, new visitor. So we had a prayer meeting followed by a Bible study. So in the prayer meeting, he jumped up and prayed. Well, that's not the end of the world. Those kinds of things happen. And he prayed that I was ministry that night. He prayed that the preacher would be freshly anointed. So I thought, oh, he's charismatic. So I just logged all this in my head. And I thought I'll have a chat with him afterwards. Do you know what he was? He was a Seventh-day Adventist. And he had come to try and turn us into Seventh-day Adventists. And we had quite a straight talk with him and told him never to come back unless he was coming back to learn. There are people out there who will try and destroy or change into their own image what is of God. This man comes up, oh, you know, I'm on your side, we're all Christians. Come with me. They were actually trying to get him to do something wrong, to go into the Holy Spirit, so then they could accuse him. Good old Nehemiah. He just went through all of these bumps on the road, and he comes out shining at the end. It's a wonder he doesn't get a mention in Hebrews 11. I love this man, Nehemiah. He got it built. He got it done. He just kept on going through all opposition, inside and outside. And you know why he was able to do it? Because he had a heart concerned for God, and he had feet that moved for God, and he had eyes that saw for God, and he had hands that worked for God, and he had a tongue that spoke for God, and he had a mind and a will set on building for God, no matter what the cost is. Let us all be Jeremiah's. Shall we close in prayer?